You're listening to Strange by Nature, your guide to the strange, weird, unbelievable, and improbable wonders of the natural world.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here today. I am Kirk Mona, and I am joined today by Rachel Ginza and Victoria Thompson. We are all professional naturalists who together have scoured the world for weird and wonderful wonders just to please your mammalian brain's desire for novelty. Isn't that nice? Let's do this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I think we can all agree that shrimp are pretty strange, right?
Yeah. Love them.
Delicious, but strange.
Well, now you say delicious. I am personally not a fan of shrimp on a culinary level. We've talked about this. It's owing to the fact that they are seafood, and we've discussed seafood is not my jam.
Yeah, you're not a fish.
It comes from the ocean. I'm not down. I will say, though, I'm also not a fan of eating shrimp in general, as there are some real environmental concerns over how shrimp are both wild caught and how they're farmed. So both have some pretty negative consequences for wildlife. Just as a quick aside on that, just so people know, like what I'm talking about, when shrimp are commercially caught, there are other species that are accidentally caught as well in the nets. It's called bycatch. And the bycatch for shrimp can be pretty enormous. For every pound of shrimp that's caught in the wild, there can be as much as 20 pounds of bycatch. So they keep 1 pound of shrimp and just kill the other 20 pounds of animals and just dump them back overboard into the ocean. So that's pretty awful, but not my topic today. It's just one of the reasons I don't eat shrimp. But when it comes to shrimp in general, other than eating them, they are pretty cool little creatures. There are thousands of species of shrimp in the world, and it's actually a little tricky to say how many there are because we keep finding new ones, and also because no one really agrees on what a shrimp is even. So generally, they are crustaceans. They have long, slender bodies, lots of little legs, and they move by swimming, and they breathe with gills. That's kind of like, generally, that's a shrimp. Where it gets confusing is that, of course, and I said this last week on the show too, but nature laughs at our little boxes.
Oh, yeah.
And we're fond of saying, we're fond of saying that because it's true. And biologically, there isn't really a thing called a shrimp. Okay, it's just a convenient title for a box we draw around some living things and go, here, these things are shrimp. And it's what we do for everything. And sometimes it works great. Fish is another good example where it's like, we're going to call these all fish, but that's kind of weird. So I will say that shrimp are generally broken down into the true shrimp and then the prawns. But there are other groups as well. Basically, any little swimming thing that looks like a shrimp gets a pass, and we're like, yeah, that's a shrimp. To be clear, shrimp is not a scientific term. It's just a common name. But it's handy, so we're going to use it. Shrimp can be found in lots of aquatic habitats. We have shrimp in the ocean, like I'm assuming most people are familiar with and many have eaten. But we also have freshwater shrimp. And most of the nature centers I've ever worked at have ephemeral or temporary spring ponds that end up having fairy shrimp in them that come out in the spring. I talked about sea monkeys at an episode on sea monkeys. Those are a type of fairy shrimp. 25% of all shrimp species known are actually freshwater shrimp.
Cool.
So my topic this week is about a new species of shrimp that was found. Rachel and Victoria, place your bets. I've already given you some information to base your guesses on. You can all obviously play this game at home as well. Though to be fair, if you shout out your answer, you can shout it out as loud as you want. I still can't hear you. I'm going to let you decide where you think this shrimp was found. Is this going to be a marine shrimp from the ocean or a freshwater shrimp from a lake, pond, or river? Make your guesses now.
Freshwater.
I say freshwater.
Freshwater? Rachel, what did you say?
I'm going to go freshwater too.
All right. Well, we'll see if you're right. The new shrimp I'm here to talk about today was in fact found on land.
What?
Question.
Land shrimp?
Land shrimp.
No.
That's right. That's right. We have a terrestrial shrimp to talk about.
Kirk.
Oh my gosh. What?
I know. It's a lot. It's a lot. Now,
why do I feel like I've heard of
this? If you guessed it was a marine shrimp, if you guessed a marine shrimp, you'd maybe technically be right because it is very closely related to a type of marine shrimp. But then again, it seems to be living off rainwater, which is freshwater. So,
I
have no idea what little box to put this into. You may have, but it's pretty recent.
How are you doing this? Yeah. This is 2 weeks in a row now that you've somehow...
That I stole something off your list?
Yeah. Just picking it out of my brain, I guess. Dang.
Excellent. Excellent. This 2 week scoop in a row. I don't know what a box to put this in other than to call it a terrestrial shrimp, which is what it is. It was found as part of an amazing and perilous expedition to a truly wild place. It was found in, I love this name, the Cyclops Mountains.
I love
this.
Oh, wow.
Where on earth is that, you might ask? Well, you might be thinking, okay, I can puzzle this out. Cyclops. The Cyclops is part of Greek mythology, so these mountains must be in Greece, right?
I bet it's in Canada.
No.
Probably not.
Not even close. The Cyclops Mountains are 12,548 kilometers away from Greece in the Indonesian province of Papua. That's almost exactly half the circumference of the globe. So about as far from Greece is as humanly possible. They were naturally named by a dead white guy from France who never visited them. That would be Louis Antoine de Bougainville, who saw them from a distance from a boat in the 1760s while circumnavigating the globe, and he decided to name them. And yes, side note, he is the guy that the flowers are named after.
Okay.
Now, if Bougainville had bothered to get off his boat, and if he had talked to the locals living there, he would have discovered, shocker, the mountains already had a name and didn't require an outsider to give them a new one.
Wild.
The local Santani people call the mountains Dobonsolo. Although I'm sure it's not pronounced that way, but it looks like Dobonsolo. Anyhow, back to modern days here. An expedition of 18 ornithologists, entomologists, herpetologists, mammalogists, geologists, and guides recently visited these dense, lush, forested mountains to explore biodiversity at the invitation of the locals.
That sounds like a great trip, by the way. Sorry.
Yes.
It might be a little challenging.
Yes and no.
For various reasons.
Yeah. So there was some amazing stuff that happened. They rediscovered Attenborough's long-beaked echidna, a species that had been not seen for 60 years.
Yep.
And was only known from one single specimen that had been originally described. They also saw Mayer's honey eaters, so it's a type of bird that hadn't been seen in about a decade, and they were relocated. The team also took video of them for the very first time, which is very cool. They've discovered a huge number of new insect species. The research, even though the expedition part, from what I understand, is over, like the research is still going on and is really exciting. To kind of counterpoint what Rachel said, and I think this is what Victoria was probably getting at, this was a tough expedition. This was not like just a stroll through the forest.
Well, I believe that. I'm more
going into the interior of Papua.
I get
it. It's real rough.
I do get that. It was more of like, I'm hanging out with ornithologists, geologists.
It was an awesome group of people.
Exactly.
I just want to tell you about a few of the things that the researchers had to deal with on this one trip.
Oh, no.
One of them broke his arm in two spots.
Oh, no.
One person caught malaria. They had to evacuate caves they were exploring when earthquakes hit. And something that has been discussed a bunch online. And I'm so sorry because you're both going to absolutely hate this. One of them got a leech in his eye.
Oh, no.
That could be removed in the field.
Oh,
no.
And he had just had to deal with it being there for something like 30 hours before they could get to somewhere where it could be removed.
No.
I'm restraining myself from using some unfamily friendly language.
Some people have described this jungle as a hellscape.
Why?
But I got to say, the researchers themselves, because there are people, they thought it was awesome. Absolutely. They're like Rachel noted, yeah. It was this amazing group of people that came together to go to mm-hmm. a place that has not been explored a whole lot by outsiders and by scientists. And pretty much in spite of some of the challenges they faced, and it was definitely a very challenging expedition, like everyone said they wanted to go back. Even the guy with, I think, the leech in his eye was like, yeah, let's do it again. So like for these researchers, they were like, this was a peak cool people. Experience. Pretty awesome. Yeah. So the great. Land shrimp they discovered was high up in the mountains. There are related species that can be found near the shore that I guess are known to be able to come up on land for like a little bit. But these species were living fully on land up in the mountains away from the ocean, which just is mind-blowing. The species has not even been named, hasn't even been named yet. That's how kind of new this is. So it definitely hasn't even been studied in depth. They just documented that it exists and want to learn more about it. We do know that it lives in a very wet jungle, which probably accounts for its ability to be on land, and that it can jump in the air to avoid predators. I did see one report online that I couldn't verify that said they could jump 4 feet, which seems absolutely insane. I could not actually verify that claim, but like that's super cool if it's true. I'm sure we're going to learn more about them in the years to come. But when I saw that, a new discovery had been made like this, I'm like, that's just cool in and of itself. I want to share that because it's so, it breaks my brain. Why is a shrimp living on land? How is an animal with gills living on land? This must be a very wet forest. How did this happen in the first place? How long have they been living in the mountains? At what point did they make the transition to being terrestrial? Like, there's all these questions. And the frustrating thing is we literally know almost nothing about this species yet.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't even been named. But I think it just brings me such joy to know that there are still strange and amazing things to discover on this planet. So I guess to everybody, stay curious and get out there and explore. My sources for this week were primarily the expedition itself. They have a website where they share all about what they're learning. So you guys can go check it out. It's expeditioncyclops.org. So pretty cool website. You can go check it out.
Love that.
And that's what I have for you this week. An amazing expedition and a terrestrial land shrimp. Like, what on earth?
Wow.
All
right. Thanks, well, Kirk. I'll give everybody a minute to get the idea of an eye leech out of their brain. And we'll take a short break. And when we come back, it'll be Rachel.
Hi, fancy folks. Welcome to Lux Sci, where we make science fun, approachable, and most of all, fancy. I'm Dr. Lex, former microbiologist, current global health consultant, and enthusiast of all the finer things in life. I'm often joined here by my husband, electrical engineer, inventor, and our audio engineer, Dr. Demos. In this podcast, we take listeners on a journey into the microscopic worlds of luxury items and unravel the fascinating intersection of science and opulence. From how bubbles form in champagne, to the molecular forces that harden clay in a kiln, to the amount of thrust needed to send a rocket to space. No luxurious topic is safe from our insatiable curiosity. We're on a mission to demystify science and show how it drives the world around us. No PhD or lab coat required. So if you've ever wondered how science and luxury seamlessly intertwine, join us as we uncover untold stories, hidden marvels, and the inner workings of scientific discovery and sophistication. Along the way, we'll also chat with amazing scientists and artisans. So subscribe now and let the exploration begin.
Welcome back, everyone. So it's been a really mild winter, to say the least, here in the Midwest.
Yes.
Even even with where I am, so last year we broke records for amount of snowfall in Minnesota, and now we're breaking records for least amount of snowfall in the winter. But we still have snow where I'm at, not much. But there's also been a ton of ice, and this just made me think about ice. We haven't really covered frost or the mechanisms of freezing on the podcast all that much because it feels more like common knowledge for a lot of us. But my really good friend, Morgan, found this phenomenon and was just like, Rachel, you need to cover this. And I just saw her and she's like, hey, when are you going to cover this? So Morgan, this is for you for when you eventually catch up and find out that I did cover your topic.
Excellent. Excellent.
And it ended up being weirder than just ice.
Okay.
So I wasn't sure what I was expecting, but it was weirder than I was expecting. So ice, for everyone who didn't know, is the solid form of water.
Well played, yes.
Good to know. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. It's what happens when liquid water is below 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 degrees Celsius in science. The molecules form like a crystal structure going from a solid to a liquid. It expands. It's a whole thing. Now, while I was researching this, I found out some rather cool things, which I haven't gone into. That's ice in general. There's a lot of really cool forms of ice. There's lots of really cool forms of frost. There's rime ice. There's hoarfrost. There's just a ton. Have either of you heard of hair ice?
Hair ice?
No.
I don't think so.
All right.
Hair ice.
Please do tell us.
So it's very specific. It's a very specific, it's also known as ice wool or frost beard. And it happens in a very specific latitude, in very specific areas of habitats. It only happens in broadleaf forests. It only happens in latitudes between 45 and 55 degrees north. So Canada, England, Germany, that kind of up. And it was
I just looked at a picture. I have absolutely have heard of this. I just forgot what it was called.
Amazing.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. So this was actually first kind of discovered or thought about like in Western science by a name I think we've talked about before, Alfred Wegener. I love Alfred Wegener.
Yes.
Love him. He was the discoverer of continental drift. And for those of you who didn't know, continental drift was laughed at while he was dead because we didn't know about plate tectonics yet. So he figured out that we all were part of a giant puzzle on landmass and then proceeded to become a laughingstock and has never found out that he was right. So good for you, Alfred Wegener. Anyway, he was on a walk and saw this phenomenon, this really thin hair-like structure on growing out of a decaying log.
Cool.
And it resembled ice. It happened just below freezing. And when he looked at it, it was just, he was very confused because he thought it might have something to do with the log that it was growing on. Because it wasn't, when you looked around on the forest floor, it wasn't happening anywhere else. It was just happening on the decaying branch. It wasn't happening on like the leaf litter or on living trees or anything like that. And we couldn't figure out why. And it turns out there's a lot that goes into it. So it has to be right after the sun rises, or before the sun rises, I should say, because as soon as the sun rises, it will melt away. But what will happen is if the log is just a little bit too cold and the air is too, it just is so specific on its formation when it comes to what it needs in order to like actually form. And the reason why it can form is because it has to have a fungus. in the wood in order to form. So what happens is hair ice, when the moisture from the wood freezes in the air and is connected to this fungus in this log, it creates a thin hair-like strand right into the air. It's absolutely wild. The it's one particular kind of fungus. It was just discovered in 2015 called Exodiopsis. Yeah. Exodiopsis. Opsis?
Here's the great thing.
We're going to do that.
Who's going to say you're wrong?
Right.
We're gonna go with that. Exodiposis effusa. I can do the second one. So it's that is the only type of fungus that actually allows hair ice to form.
Interesting.
Ice
okay.
will form, but it won't. Okay. Even if it doesn't have it, ice will still form. It just won't have that hair-like structure. It'd just be like regular.
Gosh, so you have to have both the fungus and just the right climatic conditions.
Exactly.
That might explain why I've never seen it.
Yeah, so it's pretty, it's relatively rare. You have to really like go looking for it. And it has to be in the very specific area that within that latitude. It has to be before sunrise because otherwise it'll melt. But what happens is like the fungus allows the like strands to like, it kind of goes along the, almost along the fungus, but it doesn't because the fungus isn't out there. It just gives it a little bit of a structure to give it this strand like appearance. It's a process called ice segregation. So they is how they figured out that the fungus was a part of all of this. So ice segregation is when there's water in like in the wood, it creates like a barrier between it creates a barrier that traps like liquid between ice and wood pores, and it's like a suction force, so then it pushes the water out to the surface of the ice, where then it'll extend and outward. It's kind of like ice it's kind of like extruding ice, which is very similar to what happens in like soil on frozen mornings and things.
Gotcha.
Well, I was gonna say I haven't seen hair ice, but I have seen this similar looking thing coming out of the soil. Especially this past December, I was visiting my in-laws in the Berkshire Mountains in Western Massachusetts, and I went out for a hike one morning, and it was just everywhere. Particularly, it seemed like in areas where there was moss, but these like, they did look sort of like mushrooms actually growing out of the ground, but it was ice. It was just kind of needles of ice sticking up out of the soil in a lot of different places.
Yeah. Cool. It's really, really cool. A lot of it is a lot of fun to be able to see that. I've seen that hiking up one of the several of the trails around here. It happens because we don't have a lot of soil in the first place. So, but yeah, I heard about hair ice. There's really not much else to it. It just has to have this fungus in order to stabilize, and it's like really, really thin ice. It's like 0.01 millimeters thick, so it's as thin as a piece of hair.
Oh,
it's really really thin. And it doesn't last very long, so wild times, you know, hair ice.
That would be cool to see.
It would be really cool to see. My sources this week was an article by Nick Baker, hair ice fungus, what it is, how this rare magical winter site forms. Smithsonian Magazine had a really good article, as well as the Washington Trails Association. So those were my sources this week. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, it'll be Victoria.
All right. So I was talking with my friend and Strange by Nature fan, Cora, recently. Cora's 8.
Aww.
And
hi, Cora.
They were excited to tell. Yeah. Hi, Cora. They were excited to tell me about an idea they had for the show. They were really excited about a particular very small wild cat, which they told me was extremely good at hunting. And they didn't remember the name at the time, but I looked into it. And Cora, it seems like you were probably talking about the African black-footed cat,
aww,
which is the smallest cat in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
They're super
they're
cute.
They're so,
oh my
gosh, cute.
Yeah. They look somewhat similar to a domestic cat in their body shape, maybe like a little bit stockier, mm-hmm, but they're so, oh, they're sweet. The females are only about 35 centimeters long, which is about 14 inches in their body, not including their tail. And they weigh only about 1.5 kilograms.
Okay.
And males are a little bigger, about 47 centimeters, which is 18 inches, and like around 2 kilograms. 4.5 pounds. So that's like, that would be a very small domestic cat. So these are, mm-hmm, considerably smaller than your average domestic cat.
Right.
And they have a kind of tawny color of their coat with black spots and stripes. And they're found in southern Africa in savannas and shrubby areas. They're nocturnal.
Mm-hmm.
As you might expect, they have very keen hearing and night vision. And they eat a lot of small mammals like mice and gerbils. They catch a lot of other animals too. They can leap and catch a bird on the wing.
Oh my.
And they can even take down animals that are heavier than themselves. They're extremely fierce hunters. So like they can take down a Cape hare, which is a, you know, like a kind of rabbit. And that's bigger than themselves. And here's the thing. They are extremely effective predators. Their hunting success rate is about 60%.
Whoa.
Which means that whenever they start a hunt, about 60% of the time they end up catching their prey.
Gotcha. That's awesome.
And
that's pretty high.
Yeah, that is. It's the highest measured success rate among any cat.
Wow.
And yeah, this got me thinking about hunting success. And that's really amazing for a cat. How does the African black-footed cat stack up against other predators? Yeah. So, okay, before I start getting into this, the information that is available about hunting success can be a little bit spotty.
Right.
You know, this is not fair, something that has necessarily been looked at for every possible predator. And in fact, it has not been looked at for every possible predator. For some of animals where there is some data, there may only be one study. Others may have several studies. In addition, almost all of the ones that have been studied are terrestrial animals. We just do not know anything about the hunting success of most sea creatures for understandable reasons.
Sure.
It's very difficult to do that research. And, yeah, you know, the success rate for a particular species can really vary a lot depending on all kinds of environmental conditions that it faces. But it's kind of funny, you know, a few weeks ago, Kirk, you were talking about tigers and wolves.
Yeah.
Which are some of the, mm-hmm, most feared predators, right, in, yeah, the human imagination.
Yeah, yeah. I like how you worded that. Yeah.
And wolves, for example, are not that hot. They're only successful between 6 and 20% of the time.
Wow. Yeah.
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 That's really something.
And lions, about 25% of the time. Tigers, it seems to be highly variable. Based on the studies that I saw quoted, the numbers range from 5% to 50% of hunting success. Okay.
That is a wide, yeah, range, yeah.
And yes, yeah. And as far as other cats go, domestic cats are at about 30%.
Okay.
Leopards are 14 to 38%. Cheetahs are usually 40 to 50%. Pretty good.
That's great, yeah.
And so, you know, the black-footed cat is doing very well, mm-hmm, comparatively at 60%. However, let's look at a few other types of animals.
Ooh.
All right. So the success rate of both peregrine falcons, oh, and great white sharks, okay, have been measured at about 50%.
Right. Okay.
Great white shark being one of the few marine species that we have information about. Sp- spotted hyenas, which we did a memorable episode about way back them, when. Yeah.
Nope. That was a long
They have a success
ago.
Rate about 75%.
Wow.
Nice job, hyenas.
Yeah. Well played.
Yeah. If you didn't listen to that episode, guys, go back and listen, because you might have this image in your head of hyenas as just being scavengers. Wrong. They're excellent hunters. Prepare to be disturbed by that.
All the way back.
That wasn't the part that stuck in my mind, but okay.
Yep. There's other stuff about hyenas for sure.
Yeah. So disturbing. Yeah, if you want to listen, it's episode 14.
Thank you, Rachel. Check it out. Okay. So 75%. Pretty high bar to clear. Now from here on out, we are talking about the best of the best.
Okay,
here's one out of left field. African wild dogs, which they hunt in small packs, success rate of 60 to 90%.
Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Nice.
And the only other sea creature on this list besides the great white shark is the harbor porpoise, and they had a success rate of 90% or more.
Oof.
Whoa.
That's...
chasing down little
fish.
Wow, 90%.
Dang.
That's like on par with my success rate at the grocery store.
Right.
Which
I think that's better than my success rate.
Just they're always predator, out really. Of something, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to throw something away.
If you think
away.
About it, like 90% is really incredible. Being a predator is usually very difficult. I mean, tigers who killed 33,000 people in India between whatever it was, only get 5% of their prey sometimes. 90% is amazing. It's hard to imagine getting much higher than 90, right?
That's like you missed once a
year. Hold on to your hat. You guys might know what I'm going to lead up to here, but the most successful predator currently known to science has a success rate up to 95%.
Ooh.
I'm thinking most of our listeners will have a hard time guessing. Maybe you too might have a guess. I don't know.
I want to say.
Are you asking us to guess?
Somewhat cover this animal.
I want to say.
Oh, we covered it. My first thought was like great horned owl.
Yeah.
Oh, we both went for owl. Okay.
Yeah.
Nope.
Higher than that.
Very cold.
Oh, very cold. We covered it. A predator.
You're not even...
Is this aquatic?
No.
It's a
land you're not even in the right phylum.
Is it the... not a puma?
Is it an insect?
Yes!
Ooh.
Is it spiders?
No. Spiders are not insects.
No,
what's wrong with you, Kirk?
God. You know, actually, you want to know where my brain went with that? I was thinking the fact that spiders eat insects. And my brain was like, oh, insects go into spider webs. Oh, boy. That's embarrassing.
Is it some sort of like, is it like a
wasp?
A grasshopper? Ooh, it could be a wasp.
Nope.
Not a wasp.
Nope. I mean, I don't know, maybe, but I don't know.
A grasshopper of some sort? Or a leech?
A predatory grasshopper?
Why would I say leech?
Usually you're herbivores, grasshoppers, I believe.
I was thinking praying mantis leech. Is what I was thinking.
Oh, praying mantis.
But
you said that
I think
earlier,
you said no.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yes. Okay. Nope,
we're not
getting it
here.
We are not there.
It's dragonflies.
Ooh, dragonflies. Oh, my goodness. How did I forget about
Donata.
Dragonflies? Yeah. I think I mentioned this when I talked about dragonflies.
Yes, you did.
Oh my gosh.
It was the episode
Rachel.
25.
Oh.
It was a while
she
ago.
Knows the
oh,
episode
yeah,
that number.
Was a long time ago.
I wrote it down. Yeah. So dragonflies are amazing hunters. It's really incredible how many adaptations dragonflies have that make them such effective predators. Mm-hmm. Rachel talked about it in episode 25 in more detail, but to just be brief, they have incredible 360-degree eyesight that's very attuned to anything moving. They have these incredibly maneuverable wings. They can move independently, and that means they can fly in any direction, yeah. even backward or hover.
Amazing.
And they just, bam, 95%.
Again, another animal that it's good is not bigger or it would eat us.
Yes. Let's not go back to whichever era that was when there were dragonflies with 3 foot wings.
Yeah, that was, I think, during the Cretaceous, I believe.
No, it was before the Cretaceous, right. I think.
Oh, was it before Jurassic? That?
Yeah.
At any rate, it was a long time ago, and no thank you.
Yep. No.
Yeah. That is what I wanted to talk about.
Wow.
And my sources this week were the TV program Nature, BBC Nature, and Wikipedia. Yeah. And that is what I have.
Thanks.
Wow. Very cool. Very mm-hmm. cool.
That's absolutely
I'm glad
wild.
That there's not a whole lot of those animals chasing us.
Indeed.
Thank goodness. I'm not fast enough.
Yeah. African wildcats are going to have a hard time bringing down a human.
Oh, that's going to okay be so cute to put on our Instagram and everything. Y'all should check it out.
Yes.
Well, thanks everyone for listening.
Absolutely.
I'm going to say great talking to you and
see y'all next
we'll
week.
We'll talk to you next week.
See y'all next week. Goodbye.
Thanks everyone for listening to today's show. Be sure to subscribe. New episodes drop every Wednesday, and we love sharing this strange world with all of our listeners. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, that would be great. It lets other lovers of the strange discover the show. You can reach out to us on social media by searching for Strange by Nature Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can send us an email as well. Our address is contact@strangebynaturepodcast.com. If you want more information about the show, you can also check out our website, which is strangebynaturepodcast.com. Until next week, get outside, stay curious, and embrace the strange.